that points to a new set of men's possibilities never dreamed of before. And that seems exactly to be the case. The power, the mere performing power of man, has so tremendously increased and taken on a new quality that the possibilities that open up before him for his possible creative actions seem to be almost illimitable. If that were so, and we could find it so, might help us to find out about our situation, judge it, and enable us to take position within that situation in order to make the best of it, if we could find it. This course has to do with finding out about what can we do. If we are troubled, it means that we are not satisfied with the answers given, that we do not belong to any of the numerous sects of our day who have a program to redeem the world, who believe in some ideology, who think they have a recipe that only has to be applied. We are, so to speak, non-believers in such things, at least if we are interested in such a kind of a course. So, we have to ask ourselves permanently the question, what can we do? This is a nice question, because if we take that philosophically, it shows us at once a difference from the approaches we know. Because since Plato, speaking generally, we have had two main trends of ideologies, metaphysical systems, religious systems, whatever. They try to answer two things, namely what men must do and what man should do or ought to do. Let me call, for the matter of argument, I will later have to prove that, those both trends, naturalism and supernaturalism. The naturalists, in this wide sense, are metaphysicians. So are the supernaturalists. They might call themselves materialists and the others idealists. They might call themselves religious and the others worldly. They want theists and the others atheists. Whatever names they choose, the basic trend is the same. If we analyze the questions they take up and pretend to answer, then they want to answer us the question what we must do, and the others what we should do. This seems very similar. If there were such a thing, such an answer possible straight as to what we should do, it amounts almost to a must, especially if the powers that gave us this answer are supposed to be supernatural powers. If we receive those answers by revelations of gods or divinity, there can hardly be any doubt that it amounts to a must. The fact, nevertheless, that this still implies that we might be so weak or such daring sinners that we either just do not want to do what we should or must, or that we just cannot do what we should or must do, however that might be. A certain amount of freedom seems to be given, namely the freedom of choice between the good and the evil, between that what we really should do and that what we wish so heartily to do, namely sin. The other trend tries to show us, tried for 3,000 years now, that they know what we must do. Naturalism in that sense means we pretend that being as a whole can be known, or can at least in its essence be known, so far that it is made out, it has its iron laws, its run, the so-called nature of things. When I say naturalism, so I do not mean worship of nature, or as sometimes naturalism, but mainly this belief that we could know about the nature of things, and that as far as we know about the nature of things and being, we ourselves being merely parts of being, are then compelled to certain actions we must do. To those philosophers leave us a certain minimum space of freedom. No, but they pretend to do so. The minimum space they assign to us is, best taken in the words of Karl Marx, perhaps the most influential natural metaphysician, metaphysician of naturalism in our time, in modern time, freedom is insight into necessity. That means man has a certain intelligence which might enable him to get an insight of the nature of things and so find out what in every instant and situation of his life he actually must do. But the Christian weakness is accorded to this worldly naturalistic man too. Has become not a weakness of which at least one can take a certain pride, namely the weakness of our flesh. Well, the flesh has certain enjoyments, and the weakness of the flesh is not entirely a not enjoyable thing. And such a thing as that leaves some human pride also as, for instance, the sinner. Oh, if you take a sinner like Don Juan, for instance, that's something. A man who manifests a freedom, so to speak, to know that what he does is evil, but doing it nevertheless, because he is ready to take hell upon him. That's at least an interesting figure, and one makes operas out of this figure, and we read about this figure, and that's an exciting thing. But the freedom that supposed, so-called freedom that the naturalist philosopher leaves us is a very shabby thing, and by no means exciting. It is not a weakness of character which can be so lovely and enjoyable, and it is not a strength of pride that can give us at least a certain feeling of freedom is just a weakness of intellect, just plain dumbness. If you do not see that in our historical moment you must do everything in order to bring about the victory of the proletarian class, then the train of history will just move over your dead body, and those who are sitting in it will spit on your dead body and say, he didn't get on the right bandwagon. He was not intelligent enough to see whom he had to join. He didn't know how to march with history. Poor fool, he tried to do something against history. The naturalist of the more psychological inclination might have the same set of arguments. Poor guy is not a sinner, he has no element of freedom left in him. Nothing he could take pride in after he has been so absolutely full of vice turns out to be that there is nothing that could speak for him. It is only that he is mentally in disorder. You know, something is so insane perhaps. What an insult if the person is not really insane. And cases of real insanity and real strong rotten rare. So the naturalist metaphysics, and I will later call that metaphysics, and what I mean by metaphysics, because metaphysics is a term frequently applied in very, very different, most different senses. He does not want to give us any kind of freedom, or at least he gives us a caricature of it. So both lines of inquiry, namely the ones that want to answer us the question what we should do and ought to do, and the others who want to give us an answer to the question what we must do, are very much alike in their basic assumptions. In addition to that, the assumptions are fine. It would mean if somebody really could tell us what we must do, suppose we were really not free at all. There, it would be so that we were absolutely conditioned. Then he has a busy time to show that to us. It means he has to give account really of all the movements and motions in the whole, in the all, that is so full of laws that we little ones finally, they are absolutely directed by them. Nobody ever tried that, let alone they couldn't achieve the task, it be then in infinity. That's a long time to wait. In the meantime, we shall just take for granted their assumption that our situation is really so, that we are absolutely determined through and through. The other ones, as long as they can stick to revelations, that's a fine thing, because they assemble a certain society that believes, as soon as belief is there, as William James would say, that by believing in God, then he's there. He's a reality. He is a reality for my mind, or for the mind of the society. But if the situation is so as ours, that nobody really believes in that sense, but it's just talking about religion, instead of believing, then he makes a toy out of religion, and the thing becomes perfectly ridiculous. That leaves a third line of inquiry open, a line of inquiry which is not naturalistic and is not idealistic, supernaturalistic, has nothing to do with any assumptions, general assumptions that we have to believe, a line that once has been tried and then forgotten. And a line of inquiry to which we are forced back today by our troubles. When Socrates took the saying of the Delphian oracle for the first time among all the Greeks serious, namely, know thyself, then he seems, and I hope I can prove the point, to have intended that we should start, and he started this line, a line of inquiry that does not ask, what should we do? What ought we to do? Or the other line, what must we do? But asking the question, what can we do? What can we do? And can we do perhaps so much that we can also ask the question, what shall we do? Not what should we do? All those questions and answers are questions and answers concerned with being. So let me translate that, those questions, into another set of questions. The third line of inquiry would mean, what can we do? First, let's find out what is, as far as we can know, that we do by the help of science. Science is assistance to us in philosophical matters. Science is also a controlling power. We have to check on the results of science every time. Find out what is, then find out what can be. To decide what can be is man's privilege. And then to find out what can be and then to decide, not of course the individual, but the person with other persons in a community of thinking and doing, what shall be. What can be and what shall be is the philosophical inquiry. It is non-metaphysical. It has no assumption except the assumption we name as such. Namely, we make the assumption that man is free, is a free being. This assumption we make in order to take over first the responsibility for what we are doing anyhow. Namely, we move by this assumption. We couldn't make a move without this assumption. And the men, to the contrary, who tell us that we must do things and that there is no will in man, they would have the duty to show us that they can live by the categories they think in, but they don't, because if they did, if they would really try to live by those categories they pretend to think in or think in, namely the non-existence of will, then they wouldn't be able to make a move, let alone to design whole philosophical systems. So there's a contradiction in their statements, an abyss between what they think they should do or must do, and what they think how things are. and how they act. Because they act like we, also on the assumption that man acts out of himself, that means out of will. So we only take this assumption, we confess to distinguish ourselves from those who make the assumption also, live according to it, but say that they don't. Namely, either the supernaturalists or the naturalists. We confess that we not only act according to those categories, but that we also try to think according to them, because we have a dim feeling that it would be a good thing for once to try to think in the ways one lives, and vice versa. A unity of thought and action, even if it should be a wrong one first, would have a great advantage. Namely, that we wouldn't run constantly into contradictions. C'est toujours ça. So we try to operate on this line. What can we do? What can be? What are we able to do? What shall be? That's the message. Now, technicalities. Since this line of inquiry is new and hasn't been used since Socrates, hasn't been tried, we have first to give account why we try it again. That I said, because we are troubled and do not see any other way. Second, that would be a very unusual situation. Turns out that our time, that also claims to be a time of trouble, crisis, and so on, has a specific reason for it. To say so. Namely, this specific reason is that we have nothing anymore which could give us a universal lead, a universal guidance. We have fallen out, without mostly knowing it, of the metaphysical predicament of men, because we have become critical of belief in any form. That means the supernaturalists and the naturalists try on us their tools in vain. We are to a degree skeptical that has not been met before in humanity. We do not believe in belief anymore, and that has always been done. I mean not religion only. I mean we lost the quality, the ability to start on general assumptions. We are half believers in every respect, have grown, so to speak, absolutely skeptical. That is new in the situations that mankind has yet met as a general trend in humanity. So it is at least an unusual an unusual situation has to be met by unusual means. One of the unusual means is to revive this third line of inquiry that has been forgotten since Socrates, and to try our luck with this one, because this one has for us a great advantage that it makes only an assumption that it confesses to be an assumption, and makes us skeptical as to that from the beginning. We want first to find out if we can be free at all. What indications are there? Or is that perhaps an illusion of us, that we just want to feel fine, but then where does that illusion come from? How are we able to produce such a great illusion as the qualities of freedom are? But it requires other unusual means that follow from this one, the methodical. We are in a jam as to witnesses, to take into our inquiry. If he follows this line that starts with the demand, know thyself, it means in the modern way, you really want to find out what in our time of trouble we can do. Not what is to be done, what has to be done, what must be done, but what we can do, everybody of us. We have a vague suspicion that since all the recipes doesn't help any, but makes the chaos even bigger, that that all might be our fault, that we did not earnestly consider the question that we might have to start with ourselves. We just want to do that. We want to start with ourselves. To start with ourselves means, again, to contradict every kind of inquiry we are used to, because the inquiry lines of what must we do, what should we do, always start with the beginning. They will begin with the beginning. They assume that they know something about the beginning. That's either the beginning of the world, or the beginning of the spirit, the beginning, or atoms, or whatever. We ask the question, where do we have that notion of beginning from, anyhow? What gave us that term? We have not found any beginning. We just assumed beginning. But why were we so constantly thinking about beginning? Where do we have the idea for? We get a suspicion if there is any real experience of man that gives him an inkling of beginning. It is his own inner experience that he might be a beginner. He is able to begin, to start things anew, to use conditions. He might be not entirely conditioned, he might be a conditioned conditioner. This part where he is a conditioner, we want to look into. Is he a conditioner? Does he change conditions? Does he even go farther, invent conditions, create conditions, new conditions? Is that vague term beginning, which he could never apply to anything in the world, much as he tried, due to the fact that he was dimly aware of a quality of beginning in himself? So we start not with the beginning, we start with the beginner. We look after this quality of beginning and starting in somebody, some being that we suspect to be